You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Green Left Weekly Radio.
There's one newspaper that is independent of powerful capitalist interests, and that is Green Left Weekly.
It's the people's voice, committed to human and civil rights, ecological sustainability, democracy and equality. It presents ideas that the mainstream media won't.
Green Left is a leading source of local, national and international news with analysis, discussion and debate to strengthen the anti-capitalist movement.
It helps expose the lies of the capitalist press and puts the voices of the marginalised and the oppressed at the centre of fighting for a better world and helps us understand the political developments unfolding around us.
Good morning, listeners. You are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM, and you are joined today by myself, Jacob Andrewafer, who's one of your presenters today, and then we have...
Stephanie. Good to be on the radio again.
Well, yeah, because you've been away for the past few weeks in Hobart, so yeah. It's great to have you back.
Yeah, it's wonderful to be back. So good morning, listeners.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry, listeners. I just realised that was microphone two, and I've been putting the wrong one the whole time. But I did. I think some people would have heard a faintness.
Apologies. Okay. Sorry, listeners. My name's Stephanie. I'm one of the co-presenters this morning.
Okay, so I'll go announce what we have coming up on the program. So before we start, I'd just like to acknowledge that 3CR and Green Left recognise that this show is being broadcasted from the land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung, the original rightful sovereign owners, storytellers and caretakers of the land. Australia was founded on the attempted genocide and dispossession of the First People, and we recognise that this attempted genocide is ongoing. As socialists, we pledge to actively support decolonisation. We stand with all First Nations people in their struggle for justice and their right to land. So, just to kind of announce what we have coming up on the program. There's quite a lot of headline news that we're going to get through that we probably won't have time to go through everything. I mean, there's just been a lot of political developments in the past week or so, and there's quite a lot to kind of unpack, especially in terms of unpacking, you know, some of the, you know, the kind of... Because part of what we do at 3CR is attempting to give a kind of people-centred left-wing kind of perspective on some of these events. And often how we frame things is very different from how the mainstream corporate media frames things. We will play a recording of a talk of a public forum that happened last Thursday on opposing Trump's war in Venezuela. And we're going to be playing a talk by Carlos Eduardo Moreau. So that will be happening. And then we've got an interview with Nora Mansour, who's one of the media spokesperson for and longtime Palestinian activists about the Isaac Herzog visit that's going to be coming up soon. So, yeah, and in fact, I'll just make a bit of a plug. I mean, that protest is going to be happening at 5:30 p.m. this Monday, and it's a nationwide protest. And I actually suspect that the protest will be a very big mobilisation. And I think, yeah, there's quite a lot to say about the fact that the Albanese government has invited Isaac Herzog to speak, Isaac Herzog to come to Australia. And, but we'll be talking a bit about that a bit later.
Yeah. It has been a really busy week, hasn't it, Jacob? A lot happening. Should we go into our first news item?
Oh, yes. So what was the first one you wanted to start off with?
Yeah. Well, I think we need to probably... This actually slipped my notice entirely. It wasn't until, like, I got an email from Socialist Alliance around a statement being made. And, like, the impacts of this... will be absolutely horrific. But basically, the US President Donald Trump recently signed an executive order declaring a national emergency due to the quote-unquote unusual and extraordinary threat to the Cuban government supposedly posing to US security and foreign policy. But the impacts of the order was that the US will impose tariffs on goods from any countries that directly or indirectly sell or provide oil to Cuba. And this is catastrophic because this is following the invasion and abduction of Venezuelan president. And the US has, of course, taken over all of Venezuela's oil supply and has blocked all oil supply to Cuba. And so Trump, the impacts of this would mean that Cuba would not have any oil. And now they are already experiencing the impacts of not receiving oil from Venezuela. They're already having blackouts. There's already, stories about cars being left on the side of the road. And the UN has actually also released a statement about this too, just that they'll be heading for a humanitarian crisis if this goes ahead. They've completely denounced the tariffs and of course have denounced the embargo that's been in place as breaching international law. The impacts on the people could be absolutely catastrophic, not just in an economic sense, but thinking about the food supply, thinking about all aspects of Cuban daily life and survival. I'm not sure whether we'd like to kind of share some of the Socialist Alliance statement on that, because I thought it was quite powerful, the what was said. What do you think, Jacob?
Oh, yeah, well, just to add a few things, and this kind of draws on some of the points that have been made in this Socialist Alliance statement. Really, one of the kind of things as well is, you know, this is just a clear example of US imperialist aggression, essentially threatening the sovereignty of, you know, we actually have to just make it clear. Cuba does not represent a threat to any part of the world. No. It is a small island nation that has had the experiences of, a socialist sort of revolution. Yeah. I mean, life in Cuba isn't necessarily perfect, but it is a country that very much is committed to these ideas of international solidarity. They send doctors around the world. Yeah. They have high levels of literacy as a result of the revolutionary kind of process that happened in the 1950s. But also, Cuba is also a country that is very isolated. And in fact, the material living standards of Cuba can be very difficult for a lot of people living in Cuba. That's why there's probably been a lot of people who have left Cuba over the years and migrated to other parts of the world. But, you know, the United States has been imposing these horrible kind of sanctions on Cuba since the Cuban Revolution, which essentially restrict Cuba's ability to have kind of basic kind of goods. Because Cuba is not a self-sufficient country that can produce everything that is sort of necessary in terms of having a functioning kind of society. So I think that it's completely outrageous what United States has done. And also, I think, you know, we also have to make a point about our own government, the Australian government. The Australian government is very much just a willing party to the US imperialist foreign policy. Mm. And this is demonstrated by its total commitment to the AUKUS military alliance. Mm. And I think, you know, in the Socialist Alliance statement, it says that, you know, we have to pressure Labor to break its alliance with US imperialism and pursue a foreign policy based on peace and justice. Yeah. So I think, there's what this also reflects is it reflects that the US attacks on Venezuela were just the beginning. And, you know, it has previously issued threats against Colombia, Mexico, and now it is targeting Cuba. So I think, you know, this is really, I think, you know, all left-wing people and progressive people have to oppose this this act of aggression against Cuba. Yeah. But also, I think it also has to just be put in context that, you know, the US is a violent country with a nuclear power that is essentially throwing its weight around the world to strangle countries, sovereign countries like Cuba and Venezuela.
Well, absolutely. Even, I was having a conversation with someone about this. Like, it's not like, you know, the the restrictions that were trying to be imposed against Russia for its invasion of Ukraine. Cuba hasn't done anything. They're just a little island that's just trying to survive in the Caribbean. And yeah, it's just, this is completely unjust, unlawful. It's wrong on every level. So even if you're not a radical lefty, you should still oppose this.
Absolutely. Because there's lots to say about the nature of Cuban society. In fact, we should probably do some interviews looking a bit at Cuba and also looking at the impacts of the US sanctions and also a bit of the history, because I think, there's a whole rich history that Cuba kind of represents. And, it's important for people to defend that legacy, but also I think we just shouldn't, regardless of what people think about the Cuban government or think about the Cuban state, and there's lots of different opinions, I think we should all be united, as you say, in opposing this act of US kind of aggression.
Anyway, very awful news to hear, but one for us to keep an eye on as we go about our
we'll play a quick announcement and then we'll go to the next news story, because we'll go to a local news story. Maybe we'll talk about this Bullaroo Perth Invasion Day terror attack, because there has been some... We talked about that last week, but there's been a recent kind of development. So, you're listening to Green Left. Listeners, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR, and stay tuned for more news discussion after this break.
3CR. Stay tuned, stay radical.
We demand the full restoration of all Indigenous lands and resources, and we demand the immediate cessation of all forms of exploitation and destruction of our lands.
We're here to remind you of our sovereignty and our original demand from day one.
It started with intentional genocide of our people around the round table in England. It's all lies here. Everything's a lie. It's a great opportunity right now to step into a sovereign, independent republic.
We demand a treaty. We demand our lands back. We demand to stop bloodthirsty custody.
You're back listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And I thought we'd go into another important headline news story. And this is in relation to the terror attack that happened at the Invasion Day protest in Perth, Bullaroo. And there's been a recent development on this, and it is now being declared by authorities that the attempted bombing has now been declared a terrorist attack. And to give you a bit more detail of this story, a 31-year-old man has, as of last week, and this is reported in the ABC, was charged with throwing what police described as a homemade fragment bomb filled with ball bearings and screws into the crowd which had gathered in central Perth. And WA Premier Roger Cook yesterday, confirmed that the man has also been charged with engaging in a terrorist attack. So this follows, I guess, from some of the the pressure that basically, where Lydia Forbes had First Nations Senator Lydia Forbes had spoken out about this, and basically pointing out that the silence on the Bullaroo bombing was deafening in a lot of ways, and very much highlighted racism towards First Nations people. And and she basically made the position that, this needs to be treated as an act of terror and a deliberate act of hate, directly targeting First Peoples on their day of mourning. And something that also has to be said as well, is, yes, it's true that the bomb wasn't lit off, obviously, in a lot of ways, but there's clearly a big double standard amongst our governments and also amongst the police in a lot of ways. There's often a lot of hysteria about, potential terrorist attacks that might happen in Australia. They will often use these pretenses to implement kind of repressive laws, etc. And then, of course, in the case of the tragedy that happened at Bondi, there was obviously a massive government kind of response, including discussions about implementing laws and so on. And it's just remarkable how little was said about this attempted bombing. And it took a certain level of pressure from people like the First Nation, about people like Lydia Thorpe, for the authorities to just admit that this was a terror attack.
Yeah, it was quite astounding, wasn't it? And just the lack of media coverage. It wasn't like headline kind of news. It was like down the bottom after all this other stuff going on. I do feel there was definitely an element of racism here. What police have shared so far is of that the person charged, does appear to have been motivated by, white supremacy and violent racist ideology, which is honestly what we suspected all along. Not quite sure why it kind of took so long. And the other thing that has happened as well is they haven't, like, compared to the bombing in at Bondi, where they released the details of the person charged straight away, right? Or like he was taken to hospital, but like they kind of released the details, whereas like this is taken nearly 2 weeks after. It's inconsistent.
I think this is one point I sort of add on this, and this is sort of a point that we've done some interviews about this, and it does relate a lot to the conduct of the police force. But ultimately the police within state governments actually do play the role of, they are a political institution, and so there are laws in place. Like, the reality is, I think it's probably within the law that this person's identity has been suppressed, etc., because the reality is, even though he did absolutely commit a heinous act, everyone is entitled to a fair trial and so on. So that's all, obviously that's fair, but I do think that probably, in contrast to probably what happened around Bondi, is there are elements where police might deliberately make a judgment to release particular information about a particular perpetrator of crime, etc.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can actually be motivated by the fact that actually the police do have a whole media team. They have a whole PR team. Any kind of thing that they can do to give themselves good PR. And in fact, there's people whose entire jobs within the police force is to maintain a positive PR image, PR image for the police. And I actually heard some reports actually from people who are on the ground in Invasion Day in Perth that actually the police acted quite incompetently in response to the thing when it kind of happened. I think there's probably an element of some of those dynamics at play. The fact that the police are ultimately a political institution that will play politics with the things that happen in the day-to-day work that they apparently do in terms of addressing crime and so on. I think it is a good thing that this has been recognized as a crime. I think we'll I'd like to extend all the solidarity to First Nations people. And also solidarity to Lydia Thorpe, who very much fought for this outcome to become a reality.
And also everybody who attended that rally, because they basically just survived an attempted terrorist attack. And I think, that's a really significant thing. So, thank goodness that the bomb didn't actually detonate, because, by all accounts, it sounds like it very much was intended to and would have been capable. But, there was just one thing that went wrong with that. So, just wanted to give a little update on Palestine. Unfortunately, it's been another really deadly week. Around 520 Palestinians have been killed since the so-called ceasefire went into effect about 4 months ago. And just a couple of days ago, on the 4th of Feb, 23 Palestinians were killed. The crossing from into Rafah has been kind of reopened, but not to the degree that it was meant, that Israel promised it would be. And like, so there's a trickle of people coming back through. The other thing is that, there's so many restrictions with the movement of people. And of course, yeah, so only 5 Palestinians were permitted to leave for Egypt on Monday and 16 on Tuesday. And a lot of the people who are like being prioritised to be moved are like needing urgent medical treatment. And so it's just, yeah, like they're kind of, yeah, they're denying humanitarian passage, but also, yeah, like, yeah, medical treatment by not allowing people through. So it's quite horrific. Just extending solidarity, of course, to all those impacted and the Palestinians that continue to resist and live under this like really cruel, horrific system that continues even after the ceasefire.
Well, thanks for that update, Steph. And yeah, I think all the more reason I think people should absolutely attend the protests at 5:30 p.m. this Monday outside Flinders Street Station. I think, you know, we need, you know, while with this quote-unquote ceasefire in place, we have to keep mobilising for Palestine in whatever way we can. And, I mean, I think there was quite a good protest that happened over Sunday, but I think this protest on Monday will be quite a massive kind of mobilisation. And, in fact, there's quite a lot actually happening to it, and we'll be doing a bit of the interview with Nora later.
Yeah.
The fact that there's been some splits within the Labour Party and some divisions, I think, is a significant thing. And showing that our solidarity movement is having an impact on politics.
Yeah. The other thing that really was striking when I was reading about a bit more about Isaac Herzog's visit to Australia, which like we will discuss in a bit more detail, but it is over like 5 days from the 8th to the 12th of Feb. He's also accompanied by other delegates, of course, from various Israeli national institutions, but including, how's this, the chairman of the World Zionist Organization, Yaakov Hagoel, I think I butchered that, but and chairman of Jewish Agency. But just like, it is just so blatantly an act of propaganda and so manipulative, like trying to weaponize the tragic loss of life to kind of promote Israel despite needing to answer to war crimes there's an arrest in place for Herzog, but it's just blatant, and it's so manipulative, and it's a really awful thing to put the Jewish community through as well, especially for those people who don't agree with Israel and don't support Zionism, just equating their suffering and kind of weaponizing that by promoting Israel and its racist agenda. So pretty gross.
Thanks for that, Steph. So I thought we'll play the pre-recorded speech that we're going to be playing, which is around 15 to 16 minutes long. But actually, maybe to start off, we'll play a bit of a song. So I was going to play Uda by Hamed El Sharia, who is an Egyptian Libyan Arabic pop singer, and I hope listeners enjoy it. It's a bit of a relaxed track for a Friday morning, hope listeners enjoy. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
لا زكاة ولا رحمة. كيري والخطاوي ناري من دموعي ويلي من ليالي قولي والغبي ليلي والخطاوي ناري من دموعي ليلي والخطاوي ناري من دموعي ويلي
Okay, you're just listening to Oda by Hamed El-Sharira. And so for the next part of the program, I was going to play a pre-recording of a talk by Carlos Edward Moreau, who is a Venezuelan academic based in NAR, Melbourne. And he spoke at a public forum that was organised by Green Left and Socialist Alliance, which was titled... opposing the war, Donald Trump's war on Latin America. And anyway, that forum happened on January the 29th, and I thought it was actually a very good public discussion and forum. The forum will be made available on greenleft.org.au soon, and so we'll just be playing the first talk that came from this forum. So yeah, hope listeners enjoy. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
So thank you, Sue. Thank you, Jacob, for the invite as well. And Fred, thanks for being here with us as well. Of course, I'd like to begin with a brief acknowledgement of country as well. You know, here we are standing on the lands of the Kulin Nation, of the Wurundjeri people. This always was, always will be Aboriginal land. A couple of days ago, we were, of course, many of us were at the Invasion Day rally, and I remember when, you know, I was standing quite close to Uncle Gary Foley when he was speaking at the intersection, right across, you know, the Flinders Street intersection, And there he Foley was, I think, quite happy to sort of give us his latest coinage, you know, and the new name he has for, and one of the figures who's announced on our program tonight, right? So he said, I want you all to watch out for this malignant Mussolini of Mar-a-Lago, you know? The malignant Mussolini of Mar-a-Lago. You know, brilliant, Gary, thank you. And also, you know, there at the intersection, we also heard Yaron Cousins Bundle speak as well. And she spoke about, or they spoke about, you know, quite simply, quite directly, they said, fuck Trump and the war machine. Fuck Trump and the war machine, right? So I think we can all agree with that. But I wanted to begin with them as a way of sort of centering, in a sense, you know, prominent, significant Indigenous activists, people that we respect and people that we learn from as a form of doing the acknowledgement. So the talk tonight, the public forum, is called Trump's War on Venezuela and Latin America. And of course, there are excellent reasons for us to, you know, to label it that and to focus on Trump and his war on my country and the region. But I wanted to push just a little bit against the title and just push a little bit against, in a sense, Trump's own narcissism, right? You know, which is the one that always inserts Trump in the middle of everything that's happening, yeah? And because by doing that, in a way, what we do is we approach the country from Trump's own perspective, right? So pushing against a little bit Trump's centering there. And instead, I want to talk about Venezuela, about my experience a little bit in the Bolivarian Revolution, my brief experience there, and some of the stories that friends and, you know, activists that I've been talking to over the last 2 weeks or so have been telling me. I want to share some of that in what I have to say. So let me begin by saying a little bit about my, you know, my experience back in Venezuela. So, you know, I mean, I'm a Caraqueño, I'm a Venezolano. I taught at these various universities. I had the good fortune of teaching for a little while in La Bolivariana, which was one of these experimental kind of Freirean inspired universities that Chavez set up. You know, I think that was one of these key projects that the Chavismo and the Bolivarian Revolution had put forward. But the work that I was trying to do with many other people and with many other kind of activist researchers in the CELARC in particular, at the Centro de Estudios Latinoamericanos Rómulo Gallegos, was in relation to this project, in relation to the project that the Bolivarian Revolution put forward, which was a project of 21st century socialism, right? So what was the thing that defined Chavismo and this project was, in a sense, this idea that what we were fighting for, what we were contributing to, what we wanted to be a part of was this new form of socialism, a socialism that would not repeat the mistakes, the deviations, the failures, the errors of 20th century socialism. So, you know, as a young researcher, between 2008 in 2013, I was working at the CELARC with others who were looking at kind of genealogies of Latin American integration, Latin American feminisms. My own work was on genealogies of Latin American Marxism, right? So reading Mariátegui and people like that, among others. But also looking, for example, at Venezuelan writings on oil that might push beyond the commitment to fossil fuels as the only political economy possible for a country like Venezuela. So that experience on the CELARC for me was very important, and I worked there with some very significant people and no doubt with researchers that were better researchers and activists that were better activists than me. One of them was Emiliano Terán Mantovani. So Emiliano's a good friend, and I mentioned Emiliano Terán Mantovani because while he was there, he was beginning to do work on political ecology, right? And he would then go on to set up later on, I think, a very significant project in Venezuela called the Observatorio de Ecología Política Venezolano, the Political Ecology Observatory of Venezuela, right? Very small project, three, four scholar activists involved in that, working with collectives, working with indigenous communities, looking not only what the oil industry is doing, but also looking at, for example, what mining, you know, what the illegal mining is doing and destroying in the south of the country, in particular, and towards the around the Orinoco area. I mention this because Emiliano last year, right? He's a good friend, a good activist, doing this important work in kind of political ecology. Emiliano last year had to go into hiding. He had to go into hiding for about a week and a half or so, because Emiliano was named by, at that time, President Maduro, threatened in a sense live on television for being an agent of. I guess the implication was that he'd be a CIA agent, right? But he was threatened. He was mentioned live on television and threatened for being, you know, in some sense, answerable to foreign interests, right? And the foreign interests were actually funding that he'd received to do research on political ecology with this very small project from the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, right? So I mention this as one of the stories that we could kind of like dig into to sort of understand the complexity of Venezuela, the complexity for the left in Venezuela in recent years, despite the fact that all of us supported the Bolivarian Revolution and support emancipatory politics and a socialist future in some form. So let's move into the substance of kind of the discussion. Of course, we're all here convened partly by what happened on the 3rd of January, on Saturday the 3rd of January. And what we saw there, of course, was the latest in a long history of kind of imperialist aggressions and attacks towards Venezuela and more broadly the region. What we saw was the culmination of 6 months of that kind of naval military buildup that we saw in the Caribbean, where 120 so Venezuelans and Colombians and Trinidadians have been killed, accused of being drug runners with no proof, and killed by imperial feet, you know, because the US can simply decide this extraterritorially. But of course, those are the last 6 months. But before that, we can jump to the 10 years of sanctions on Venezuela, which began in 2015 and are still there. And then, of course, we can push further back and refer to close to two centuries of neocolonial interventions. And everyone's heard recently about the Monroe Doctrine and, you know, potentially renamed the Donroe Doctrine, right? So this is an ongoing history. And on that attack on the 3rd of January, we had numerous communities were affected in popular parts of Caracas, El Paraíso, Fuerte Tiuna itself, the military barracks, the military sort of area where President Maduro was held, but which is also now a popular area, right? Because there's buildings and people live in there. But also further out, La Guaira, you know, the coastal area where the airport is and other areas. We had 100 people killed, 100 citizens, citizens and soldiers, young soldiers that were sort of killed, sacrificed there, defending their country, defending my country. So in total, we have 230 people killed if you look at the past 6 months plus this aggression from January and the 3rd. Having said that, I also think it's important to, you know, take the next step and then also say that this attack happened on the 3rd of January. Of course, what did Trump and Rubio and Vance do? They kidnapped President Maduro, as you all know, kidnapped Maduro and Cilia. And one of our demands has been, I think, in these various solidarity spaces, and one of the demands has to be, of course, the return of President Maduro and his wife to Venezuela. Not necessarily because we support their politics, but rather because Maduro and Celia Flores should be in Venezuela, and because self-determination and sovereignty matters, and this, you know, the we're the ones who should decide who's president, who's in power. The US should have no role in any of this. I've been thinking a little bit about how we can kind of move into this discussion of sovereignty and self-determination, right? Because these are some of the key themes that are at play here. And one way to approach this, and I'm here leaning on the conversations I've been having with friends, peers, activists back in Caracas mainly, is to say that yes, sovereignty and self-determination were attacked on the 3rd of January, but in a way, right now, sovereignty and self-determination in Venezuela remain suspended, right? We have suspended sovereignty, suspended self-determination. I'm sure you've seen, and maybe you've participated in some of these discussions or conversations about whether the Rodriguez brother and sister duo, Delcy Rodriguez and Jorge Rodriguez, did or did not collaborate in some manner with this. I don't know, and I don't think that's quite the discussion that matters for us. But it is true that, for example, we saw a week or so ago the CIA director being welcomed to the country, right? As together with the US embassy being reopened in Caracas. And there are a lot of people within Chavismo, within Madurismo, and on the left that are looking at these things and are kind of, you know, appalled, are questioning this, and are wondering what's going on, right? So, suspended sovereignty, suspended self-determination. One way to think about what's happened in Venezuela, I think, would be to look at Trump's model for Gaza, right? What have we seen recently in Gaza? We've seen Trump speaking about the creation of this board of peace, of this farcical, ludicrous board of peace, to which he's been asking people to contribute $1 billion or so to participate in, right? What is this board of peace planning to do in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip? Well, it's presenting a future of peace, but where peace means real estate, asset valuation, and security for capital accumulation via real estate. The future that this suspended sovereignty, suspended self-determination that Trump and Rubio and Vance have sort of put forward for Venezuela is not dissimilar in a sense. It's one where ultimately what matters is having Venezuela's oil resources on the ledger of the oil majors, even if they don't extract it. They intend to, of course, but even if they don't extract it, we already saw a huge jump in the price of the shares of all the oil majors, 7%, 17%, 21% days after the announcement, right? But you all know that's how capitalism works. So I want to talk a little bit about what the government of Delcy Rodriguez has been doing in the last couple of days in relation to oil. And then the discussion about how we do solidarity and stuff, we can maybe have it a little bit in the Q&A, I think. So the country right now is going through a very significant moment. Of course, you know, this is obvious. And one of the sites for this transformation, for this discussion, for this suspension of sovereignty and self-determination is around the proposed new hydrocarbons law, the new oil law that the government of Delcy Rodriguez is putting forward, right? So we had the attack on the 3rd of January, Maduro kidnapped with Celia Flores. And then on the 10th of January, I think on the 10th of January, Delcy Rodriguez, after she'd been sworn in as the new president, spoke to the National Assembly and there said, you know, I'm presenting this is what we achieved last year, this is what Maduro achieved last year. So it's sort of like a storytelling of 2025. And there, she presented a series of new laws that she hopes the National Assembly will pass. One of these new laws, presented, as I say, a week after the attack, is a reform of Venezuela's oil law. And you know, to cut a very long story short, I'll basically say that this law is a neoliberal law. It's a neo-colonial law that is privatizing the oil industry. It's essentially handing over Venezuela's oil industry to the oil majors. There's some technical stuff that I can kind of get into. My doctorate was on the politics of oil, so part of me gets excited about these sorts of things, so we can talk a little bit more about this. But just to give you one element here that I think is quite significant is, of course, so much of Venezuela's left politics, so much of Venezuela's kind of democratic politics throughout the 20th century were about claiming ownership over the oil industry, right? So you could tell the whole story of Venezuelan left politics largely in relation to how these groups, collectives, parties, movements approach oil, right from the beginning of the 20th century up until now. What was Chavismo with its promise of a socialism for the 21st century, a different kind of socialism? Well, part of Chavismo was the promise that we could use oil resources, oil rents, to fund this different socialism. So this reform of the oil law, one of the things it's doing now is it's going to reduce royalties, for example, right? So royalties since 1999 with the Bolivarian constitution, 2001 with the oil law that was drafted back then, and then the reform in 2006. So basically since the beginning of the Bolivarian revolution up until now, royalties were at around 30%, right? So joint ventures, oil companies had to pay about 30% on royalties. Now that's being reduced to 20% or 15%, so it's being halved, right? So that's pretty concerning. But there's another thing, there's another kind of element there that is even more concerning. In the 1990s, in the deep neoliberal moment in Venezuela, which is what Chavez revolted against and what many of us decided to side with and participate in, you know, the revolt against kind of the neoliberal moment in Venezuela and in Latin America. In the 90s, the neoliberal discussion was one that spoke of explotación a riesgo, extraction, risky extraction would be an easy way to translate this. And the idea was that if you were going to produce or extract oil, we should consider the risk of the capitalist, we should consider the risk of the oil majors, and that might be a formula through which we reduce the royalties even further. So from 30%, 20%, 50%, but if your extraction is happening in a space or in a place where you might not hit oil, well, you know what? We can reduce the royalties even further, 10%, 5%. And this formula, which was a neoliberal formula, which was, you know, discussed much in the 1990s and which Chavez obliterated, has come back. It's there again in the new reform, oil reform law. And so this, you know, this and other elements are kind of concerning. Very concerning. One more element to kind of round out the picture has to do with the offshore accounts. So up until now, for example, if an oil company is working in Venezuela, when they sell the oil, that money has to come back to Venezuela, to the central bank. From now on, according to this law, any oil company that is working in Venezuela can be paid on offshore accounts outside of the country. So this money will never come to the country, and it will just feed the circuits of finance and capital, most likely in North America, in the US, right? So kind of standardizing once again, or returning to the typical flows of value that we know. What are the government justifications here? And you can imagine them. Well, we've heard both Delcy Rodriguez and Jorge Rodriguez, a brother, president of the National Assembly, and a few others, speak of, well, you know, what's the use of having the world's largest oil reserves if we can't extract them? We need to extract the oil for development. Or, more problematically, perhaps even a little bit more cynically, climate change is coming, and we're going to have all these stranded oil assets that we won't be able to extract, so we better get pumping oil out now, right? So you know, there's plenty there to question, to criticize. But what I think is truly extraordinary is that this oil reform law comes partly to sort of open up oil and the oil industry and in a sense kind of disassemble this whole history of left politics in the country, to open up the oil industry for a government, a state that, you know, put over 100 sanctions against Venezuela, against the state, against the government and the people of Venezuela, took over Venezuelan assets in the US, bombed Caracas, kidnapped the president, and killed its citizens and soldiers. So Delcy's law, Delcy's oil law, is in a sense also Trump's oil law. And there are people on the left in Venezuela with whom I'm in dialogue that are calling this moment a moment of Delcy Trumpismo, a Delcy Trumpist moment. What are our friends on the popular and kind of Marxist left in Venezuela saying, our socialist friends saying? Well, they're saying we need public forums, neighborhood assemblies to discuss what's happening, because the narrative that we're getting from the opposition, of course, we're not even going to touch on it here, but not worth discussing it perhaps, but the government itself is not presenting a truthful narrative, right? And the government is insisting that what is happening is, as I said, you know, security, peace, and development, right? That's kind of the story we're hearing there. So our friends on the left are calling for the need for public forums and neighborhood assemblies to discuss together what's happening in the country, to understand this new reality of suspended sovereignty, and neoliberal, neocolonial oil handover, and perhaps the need to also organize to resist. And just to name some of these groups, there's many, but I mentioned one. I mentioned my friend, my colleague in the Observatorio de Ecología Política de Venezuela, the Political Ecology Observatory in Venezuela, Emiliano Terán Mantovani, and a few others there. But also groups and parties and movements that might be known to you, the Partido Comunista de Venezuela, the Communist Party of Venezuela, is calling for these assemblies to talk and organize. Marea Socialista, which is a Trotskyist party, which used to be part of the PSUV and were expelled from the PSUV, are also calling for these assemblies to, you know, discuss, inform, and organize. And so are many other groups. But to change tack briefly and what is remarkable is that the oil reform law and the opposition, in a sense, the opposition to the government of Maduro before, the opposition to the government of Delcy now, kind of coincide on this question of extracting oil, privatizing oil, and pumping out oil, right? Both sides agree on that, right? And both agree on the need to, you know, right now Venezuela is producing, extracting about 1 million barrels of oil a day, 1,200,000 barrels. Both want 6 million barrels. That's the magical figure that both the right-wing opposition and the government are kind of looking at. Both of them are happy to look beyond something that matters to all of you as Socialist Alliance friends, people and planet, eco-socialism. Both are happy to ignore the reality of the civilizational crisis that fossil fuel extraction and oil dependency presents. And so what is to be done? Что-то делаешь, to quote our friend Lenin. Well, my thinking here is very simple. Like I think anti-imperialist work is always about building popular power and workers' power. So building popular power and building working class power. This is in essence a democratic form of power, and I think this is how we halt US aggression. This is how we halt Trump's attacks or imperialism. This is the best chance we have, you know, to organize as workers and to organize as people in our territories, in our neighborhoods. I collaborate with LASNET because LASNET tries to do that, right? LASNET works with the MST in Brazil, and LASNET works with unions and the Congreso de los Pueblos in Colombia, which is now, you know, also under threat from Trump. LASNET also works with the Zapatistas in Mexico. But I think we need to do more work here, you know, to identify other groups and collectives and organizations that we can kind of collaborate with to do this internationalism, which the left has always done since the 19th century. Why? Because governments can be flipped, right? Governments can be flipped, and that's partly my reading of what has happened with the government of the Rodriguez brothers, and because individuals can be corrupted, right? So our work has to be with collectives and people on the ground. So I've spoken mainly about Venezuela, but I know we want to talk more broadly about Latin America as well, and I look forward to that in the next couple of minutes. Thank you.
All right. You're just listening to Carlos Eduardo Morao, who was speaking at a public forum titled Opposing Trump's War on Latin America, which was organized by Green Left and Socialist Alliance on January 29th. Yeah, hope listeners enjoyed that. I'm just going to go play a quick announcement. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
The media in this country, we as Indigenous people know, have censored our right of telling the truth. And the truth is what this country is most fearful of, in particular Indigenous truths. Until history is told by the vanquished lens, which is our people telling our story our way, and have the right to be able to incorporate that into a system of learning, well, people are always going to be denied that truth by deceit and lies. When you look at the type of psychological warfare, spiritual warfare that Aboriginal people are caught in, it's not just in the sense of military when they talk about weapons of mass destruction, but you're right, it's in terms of the media and the industry of media as a warfare against our people, and so is religion, I believe, in the Western sense. They're all weapons of mass destruction against our people.
We need to keep radical voices on air. Subscribe now.
Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And I thought I'll give a bit of a overview of this article I wrote for Green Left, and it's just been published, and you can read it online, and it's titled Oxfam Report Highlights How Billionaires Rig Politics. So this is an article that I wrote drawing on Oxfam's latest global inequality report, which was released during the World Economic Forum in Davos on January 19. And this reveals how billionaires use their extreme wealth to keep profiteering and maintaining infrastructure of sympathetic politicians, medias, and bureaucracies in place. What it kind of, and this report titled Resisting the Rule of the Rich, Protecting Freedom from Billionaire Power, found that globally, billionaire wealth rose by more than 16% last year, reaching a record $18.3 trillion. One of the report's more alarming statistics is that last year, billionaire wealth increased 3 times faster than the average annual rate over the previous 5 years. Mm-hmm. And since 2020, Oxfam said billionaire wealth has grown by a whopping 81%. Billionaires' fortunes have grown at a rate 3 times faster. And of course, the report probably does do quite a bit of work, especially in relation to this whole question of billionaires and democracy. It kind of points out that, you know, Trump's champion of deregulation and undermining of agreements to raise corporate taxes have only kind of benefited the rich and the powerful. Trump's presidency brings into sharp relief what billionaire rule means for the capitalist system. It exposes its democratic facade as well as its potential to further deepen inequality. And probably one of the elements as well is it kind of talks about you know, what do the super rich often do with their extreme wealth? And, you know, basically, you know, the billionaires use mechanisms that are a direct challenge to democracy. The report argued that billionaires' massive wealth allows them to subvert democratic institutions, including by spending big on legal costs to thwart any legal challenges to their methods. It points out that billionaires use different mechanisms to directly undermine democracy. This include buying politicians and political parties. Billionaires also own and therefore control the mainstream media and artificial intelligence, which they use to promote far-right policies, including scapegoating refugees, migrants, and other oppressed groups for capitalism's failure. And the report said that worldwide, billionaires are at least 4,000 times more likely to hold political office than non-billionaires. So just to kind of conclude, you know, the lesson which Oxfam seeks to draw out is that growing inequality is a direct threat to democratic rights, and democracy is fragile when the world's 12 richest billionaires have more wealth than the poorest half of community, more than 4 billion people. Economic inequality becomes political inequality, Oxfam said, adding that any resistance to extraordinary economic hardship is met with greater repression. And of course, yeah, it said the one good thing about the Oxfam report, because I think Oxfam usually are, you know, they do put a lot of focus on sort of lobbying, and, you know, they kind of make these arguments that, you know, we just need to tax the billionaires. Well, how are we going to force those taxes? They do make a bit of a nod to the need for people to kind of resist. And, you know, that is something I write that we agree with, because we need to have people-powered sort of movements. And I'll just make a bit of a point, concluding this point. I mean, 3CR is currently having a subscriber drive. You know, I think it's very important to keep community radio on air. We need as many subscribers as possible subscribing to 3CR. So, yeah, I'd just like to make a case that, yeah, become a subscriber of 3CR.
Yeah. Yeah, it's important to give, yeah, everyday people a voice, a genuine voice, and not one controlled by mainstream media, because, yeah, I mean, that's the other thing, isn't it? Like, the ruling class very much control the flow of information and, yeah, through the media. And so, yeah, it's by supporting community radio like 3CR, you're actually engaging in resistance too, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, well, I'll play a quick announcement, another subscription announcement, and then we'll go into the Green Left activist calendar.
This deal really accentuates and is very complementary to the White Australia domestic policy. Here you have not only a white alliance, but an Anglo-Saxon alliance of the ultimate cultural allies of the United States banding together, and the significance that it is aimed at colored peoples, at Asian peoples, at Pacific peoples. This is injecting a horrible racial dimension to this conflict. So I think the US and Australian elites' racist military policies are complementing the increasingly racist domestic policies. So I think, therefore, we really have to look out very, very carefully at this very dangerous synergy between racism on the military front and racism on the domestic front.
Subscribe to 3CR. Where else can you hear radical news, analysis, music, and opinions? Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 03 9419 8377.
All right, it is now time for the Green Left activist calendar. So maybe I'll pass on to Steph to start announcing the first few events.
Yes, so you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 8:55 AM. And today, and I'm going to stumble over the pronunciation of this, Jacob, so feel free to step in if you know.
Mean, you can't trust me with pronunciation, but yeah.
All right, so I do apologise to First Nations people, because I will probably mispronounce these, but tonight we've actually got a couple of film screenings happening. So at 6 p.m. there's a film screening called Amrika at Dakana, 99 Harding Street, Coburg. There's also a film screening happening at the Resistance Centre tonight at 6:30 p.m. And the screening is of Gunawaya Nigu. Apologies, listeners. I'm sure I've stuffed that up. So that's at the Resistance Centre, level 5, 407 Swanson Street in the city. Then there's a reading group as well on tonight, the Jakarta Method at 6:30 p.m. Kathleen Syme Library, 251 Faraday Street in the Activity Room in Carlton. Tomorrow we have the Northern Suburbs for Palestine 2026 Strategy Day at 12:30 p.m. until 5 at the Schoolhouse Studios, 28 Victoria Street in Coburg. This Sunday, wonderful. There's some music events happening. There's music Rage Against Racism, 1 p.m. at the Tote. What an amazing venue that is. 67 to 71 Johnson Street, Collingwood. And then there's the smoking ceremony, 2:30 p.m. at Camp Sovereignty on King's Domain in Linlithgow Avenue, Melbourne. And then this Monday, which we'll hear about the upcoming rally in a little bit more detail, but we have the rallies happening nationwide, but the rally in Naarm or Melbourne will be at Flinders Street Station, 5:30 p.m. protesting the Israeli president's visit. So the rally is Isaac Herzog Not Welcome Here. Again, 5:30 p.m. at Flinders Street Station. It'd be great if everybody is able to attend that one. It's really important. And then on Saturday, the 21st of February, we've got the Belgrave Survival Day at 2 p.m. Bill Borthwick Park, 65 Best Street in Belgrave. And then there's a film screening, Until the Sky Falls Quiet, 3 p.m. Ferntree Gully Uniting Church at number 6, The Avenue in Ferntree Gully. And there's many more events on our calendar in Melbourne, in Geelong, and all around the country. So I encourage you to go to greenleft.org.au/events for further details.
All right. I'll just make just two last announcements, just to make a note that there's going to be the public forum Unite to Fight Racism at 6:30 p.m. at the Victorian Trades Hall, 240 Lygon Street in Carlton. So that'll be a good event to come along to. I might just go. We'll finish up there, and we'll actually go play. We'll play another song. So I thought we'll go play Blue Planet Eyes by the Pretoriaans. Hope listeners enjoy. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
We'll be right back.
All right. You were just listening to Blue Planet Eyes from the Brochures. Okay, so we're very happy to be joined by our first live guest on the program. And we are joined today by Noura Mansour, who is a longtime Palestinian activist and one of the media spokesperson for the upcoming protest against Isaac Herzog. Noura is also the National Director of Democracy in Colour and has been very much key to organising a lot of the major kind of Palestine demonstrations for the past 2 years. So good morning, Noura.
Good morning, Jacob, and good morning to you and your listeners.
All right. So can you tell us about, the importance, I think, of why people are protesting against the visit of Israeli Prime Minister Isaac Herzog, who has been invited by the Albanese government, and I think why it is very important that we, build a massive opposition to his visit, including being part of a big protest?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So our government invited the president of a state that is on trial at the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, for committing the crime of genocide. Israel has been found by international bodies such as the International Court of Justice, United Nations, and human rights organizations, including both Israeli and Palestinian, to have caused and continue to cause deliberate destruction to civilian infrastructure, including hospitals, schools, and universities in Gaza, killing over hundreds of thousands of Palestinians and intentionally starving a besieged population of over 2 million people. Now, Isaac Herzog has made statements that, according to the United Nations, amount to incitement for this unfolding horrific genocide that we are watching, that is being live-streamed to the world, has been live-streamed to the world for at least over 2 years now. He's signed missiles. There's pictures of Isaac Herzog signing missiles. There's statements of him basically blaming an entire nation, and saying that there's an entire nation responsible for the actions of some, the gross generalization, a fallacy of generalization. And now we have our government rolling the red carpet for someone like that. Despite the fact that his role is symbolic, he is a representative of a state that has been committing genocide against 2 million people. Now, it's important to address the role of the Australian government in this unfolding genocide. So for the last 2 years, our government has been enabling this genocide by continuing its business as usual with Israel. And despite, ongoing continuous broad calls from Palestinian community, from the civil society and the broader movement, anti-war movement and movement for justice here on this stolen land, the government has chosen to continue its support for Israel, violating its obligations under international law, Geneva Convention and the Genocide Prevention Convention. It's important to protest his visit because the message that we are sending as civil society to the world in terms of accepting war criminals and people such as Yitzhak Herzog is a very strong message. And this is the world that we want to live in. We're shaping the world that we want to live in. What kind of message we're sending to our children, the people watching. An invitation to someone like this can be translated and interpreted as an endorsement of his statement and the actions and acts of his government.
Yeah. I'll pass on to Steph to ask the next question.
Yeah. Hello. Just wanting to get your thoughts on this, but Chris Sidoti says that Herzog should be arrested for the crime of inciting genocide. What would you say to that?
We agree. We absolutely agree that anyone who's incited genocide, whether be that Herzog or other Israeli officials, Almog or other people who are actually joining him on this trip, should be arrested for the crime of genocide. It just goes to show, and the refusal of our government to actually, starting with this invitation, but also refusing to listen and change and pivot. Despite the mass mobilizing that's happening against his visit, is indicative of how deeply entrenched and institutionalized anti-Palestinian racism in this in this country. We've heard statements from Penny Wong and other officials saying that his visit is a good thing. And we can't help ask the question, who is it good for? Mm. It's definitely not good for the Palestinians who are being starved and bombed to death in Gaza. Mm. It's definitely not good for the Palestinian community here. And it's not good for the broader civil society as the government introduces tougher measures and restrictions to basically restrict our fundamental right to protest. And it's not good for the Jewish community who is still mourning post-Bondi to be associated with a state that is on trial for genocide and to have a figure like Herzog and to have their grief really used for political gain.
Yeah, thanks for that, Nora. And I guess going to the Albanese government, the Albanese government's kind of response to the visit has been quite interesting because we are starting to kind of see some divisions within the Albanese government. It's clear to me that there are some Labor politicians, although I think, you know, they could be speaking out a lot more, clearly don't necessarily think it was a good idea to invite Isaac Herzog. But of course, we then have our state premier Jacinta Allen basically saying, oh, yes, we welcome him coming. And in fact, I've actually heard that there's some rumours that he is going to be in Melbourne on the 12th of January. So, yeah, I want to kind of hear your comments a bit about some of that dynamics with the Albanese government's response to his visit.
Yeah, I think what the Albanese response is also reflective of this gap that we were well aware of, this gap that exists within the Labour, between Labour leadership and its base. And it's something that's been going on for a few years now, since the genocide. It just goes to show how disconnected the leadership, the Labour leadership, from its base and its membership base and its supporters, and the fact that it just refuses to listen, which is quite risky for leadership, thinking about sustainability of the Labour as well. The response has been, offensive to say the least, to not just Palestinians, but just people broadly. Anyone with common sense, anyone who's attached to their humanity. I mean, we think asking us to respect a visit of a war criminal is highly offensive. The government should be respecting human rights and the sanctity of human lives. And they should be refraining from using tragedies and massacres happening here in Bondi or in Gaza for political gain. We wish that, you know, the government stops and seizes these divisive tactics that drive division between racialized and marginalized communities on this land. We still call on the government to cancel this visit and to arrest someone who has been found inciting against genocide.
All right.
Inciting for genocide against Palestinian people.
Yeah, yeah. So thanks for that, Nora. And I guess we'll go into, I guess, the last kind of question. With any kind of final comments from you, but also details about the upcoming protest that is happening this Monday?
Yeah, thank you. So on Monday the 9th at 5:30, there is a National Day of Action that is being organized across the continent by the broader movement for justice, anti-war, anti-genocide, and Palestinian rights, Palestinian justice, to basically send a very strong message that war criminals are not welcome on this continent, not on this stolen land, and that inviting someone like this is an affront to our humanity and an offense to our collective humanity as civil society. So it's important for people to join this message that we are a movement for justice, for freedom, for equality, for liberation, decolonization, and we will stand together despite all attempts to divide the movement. We will stand together, people from different walks of life, different religious, different ethnic identities, be that Jewish, Palestinian, Arab, Muslim, and obviously, first and foremost, First Nation folks, First Nation people, to send a strong message that we oppose genocide and we oppose genocidal politicians.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for that, Nora. And yeah, just think, I just want to make a bit of a plug to our listeners. Definitely, absolutely should get to the protest that's going to be happening this Monday. And yeah, all the solidarity with you, Nora, and the broader Palestine Solidarity Movement. And thank you again for being on our program.
Thank you very much, Jacob. See you on Monday, Flinders, at 5:30.
Yeah, see you on Monday. All right, so we're just speaking to Nora Mansour, who is one of the Palestinian organizer who is part of the big protest against Isaac Herzog's visit. And yeah, just another thing to highlight about the protest, it is going to be a nationwide protest. So you might be listening to this, from a different state, from Victoria. And just want to make the plug that it should absolutely get find out if there's a protest happening in a local area. Yep. There's potentially some protests happening in regional cities in Victoria as well. And you can find out all the details actually about the protest. We've been keeping it updated on the Green Left website. Anyway, I'm just going to go play a quick announcement. And you're listening to Green Left Radio, and we'll probably play a song as well.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
All right, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR. And so I thought we'll have a few more comments after this, but I thought we'll play one last song for the program. And this is a song by Sayult. It's Sault. And the song is called Don't Waste My Time. Hope listeners enjoy.
Don't wanna break your pride. waste my time, I ain't got time. Don't care what you say, nothing in your brain looks like mine. Don't waste my time, please don't waste my time, I ain't got time. Don't care what you say, nothing in your brain looks like mine.
Welcome back to Green Left Radio. You're listening to 3CR 855 AM, and that song was Don't Waste My Time by
Salute.
Salute. Very groovy number. Well, listeners, that just about does it for today. We just want to thank everybody for tuning in this week. I would like to thank Naura for joining us on the show to talk about the protests against President Herzog's visit. We want to encourage people to read more online. You can head over to greenleft.org. You can read stories that we talked about today. There's videos, there's analyses, there's book and music reviews, and yeah, just a ton of content and a very, very flashy podcast on there as well that you can listen to. We'd like to encourage people to consider subscribing, consider supporting Green Left from as little as $5 a month. You can also donate to our Fighting Fund to help us continue reporting on workers, climate and social justice movements. You can head to greenleft.org.au/support to help us out. And every little bit helps, no matter how big or small. You can also follow us at Green Left Online on social media for the latest news and analysis. Like I said, we've got a fantastic podcast, the Green Left News podcast. This week we've got episode 55, Purple Pingers on Housing Solutions. That should be a bit fun to listen to. And also, please consider subscribing and supporting 3CR. 3CR is a fantastic community radio. They run just many really important programs for progressives and the left in lots of different languages, covering a wide range of topics. So please head to 3cr.org.au/subscribe, become a subscriber or make a donation at 3cr.org.au/donate.
All right, thanks for that. And yeah, I'd like to stay tuned for Left After Breakfast. You're listening to 3CR.
Bye.
This brings us to the end of the show. You have been listening to Friday Morning Breakfast with Green Left Radio, brought to you by Green Left Weekly Newspaper, which brings an alternative source of information that puts people and planet before profit.
If you like our work, become a supporter from $5 per month at greenleft.org.au/support or free call 1800 634 206.
Arise, you workers from your slumbers. Arise, you prisoners of want. For reason in revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of Khan. Away with all your superstitions, serve all masses,
arise!
We'll change henceforth the old tradition and spurn the dust to win the prize. That's right, the commies are back, reds underneath your beds in that crack.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.